Hello, everyone. Welcome to the bonus episode. And I am back from my travels. So I've been in the village where I grew up in Wiltshire outside Salisbury. And then I've been on a cricket tour to Cornwall. But I'm now back in London, which is swelteringly, revoltingly, sweatily hot. But Dominic, you have now gone on your travels. So you're now on holiday. So where are you?
So Tom, I'm on island in the Stockholm Archipelago. In Sweden. So it's not, it's warm and it's sunny, but it's not too hot. As people who listen to the Love Island, I can't remember, did we talk about this in the Love Island results podcast?
Yeah, we did.
I've been for a swim this morning in the Baltic, very cold.
Do you feel better for that?
I do, actually. I feel really invigorated.
Revitalize yourselves, doesn't it? It makes you younger.
Do I look younger?
You do.
I don't.
You're looking quite shaven headed.
Oh, thank you. That's nice. Well, I have had a haircut. Yeah. I mean, that's the reason. Yeah, I am looking quite shaven headed. I like to have a haircut before I go on holiday.
but who is that handsome debonair Englishman?
Yeah, I basically I want to look like a football hooligan from 1983 or something. So that's the look I try to cultivate on holiday.
One of my favourite comments ever made by anyone who's ever listened to this podcast. Do you remember the episode we did on statues?
I do.
And there was a photo of you and me looking up at some statue, and somebody described you as an England fan getting ready to boo the team for taking the knee.
I remember that. I do remember that. Yeah.
But it was quite an accurate description.
It was a good, because it did look like that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, so that's the image. I try to strike fear into to foreign hosts by looking as though I might start throwing chairs at their riot policemen at any given moment.
But Sweden, the home of the Vikings, especially.
Yes.
And so you must be near Birka, are you?
Birka's the other side of Stockholm. But I'll tell you what we're going to this afternoon, Tom. So this is my day for Rest is History listeners. So once I've done this bonus podcast, we're going into the centre of Stockholm to pick up my sister-in-law, Rachel Morley, of the Friends and Friendless Churches, who did two podcasts with us, because she's coming to stay with us for a few days. And then in the afternoon, we might go to the world's largest Viking exhibition at the Swedish History Museum.
So is it bigger than the new one in Copenhagen, which I saw a few months ago?
I think it must be, although this may be some inter-Scandinavian sort of source of bitterness. I don't know. I've been to that one in Copenhagen. But
have you been to the new one?
No, I've been to the old one. Arthur dressed up in as a Viking at it.
Yeah, well, every Scandinavian museum has that, doesn't it?
It does.
They kind of lay on things for children to dress up in.
Exactly, fur cloaks and wooden swords and stuff.
The one in Copenhagen, I think, opened earlier this year. So when I went, it had been open just for a few weeks.
Yeah.
So I'd be interested to know whether
I shall report back
if the one in Stockholm is even bigger.
I shall report back.
That sounds great.
What I look for in a Viking museum, Tom, I don't know if you agree, I look for an exhibition that leans very much into the axes, the severing of heads.
So not the textiles.
Textiles and multicultural exchange, I can take or leave, frankly. I mean, frankly, I can leave. I'm not that bothered about all nice weaving. If you look at the people walking around the exhibition, no one gives a damn about all that stuff about, like, nice, you know, rugs. They just want... Bring me the swords, bring me the Islamic coins, mm-hmm. bring me the looted manuscripts or whatever. The rune stones, that's what I'm after.
I'm not disputing that. Anyway, well, look, have a wonderful time. We have a very good question here from Yorkist. Who from history would you like to have been? I don't mean in the sense of being you in a particular person's situation. I mean, whose life would you actually have liked to have led, warts and all? Are you a glory hand prepared to kill millions of people so your name will be remembered? Or someone who wants a quiet life, thinking or painting or writing popular history books?
Oh, I mean, that's what I'm doing already. I mean, I'm writing popular
history
books.
You want to be you?
Well, no. I mean, I want to be... That's a
magnificently complacent answer.
I would know. I'm saying I'd like to do something different. I probably would be... Who would I be?
Because I knew this question was coming.
I have
one already prepared. So shall I give you my answer?
Is it Lord Nelson?
No, it's not Lord Nelson. Lord Nelson died horribly.
Yeah, he also had trouble with his...
He lost his arm.
He had great stomach troubles, always complaining about his stomach troubles. Go on.
He got seasick. I mean, yeah. we're going to be doing something on the Battle of Trafalgar, aren't we? So, Nelson.
So, who would you have been?
Okay, so this basically a variation on this appears in the first work of history ever written, Dominic, of course, yeah. by Herodotus.
Yeah,
and Herodotus describes Solon, who was an Athenian lawgiver and ranked as one of the seven wise men of Greece. And Solon went to see Croesus, the king of Lydia, who traditionally is rich. The guy who invents coinage. Yeah, so rich as Croesus. And Croesus was a byword for prosperity and good fortune, everything that he touched, rather kind of Midas style, but without the unfortunate side effects, turned to gold. So he was a famously happy, prosperous king. And Solon went to see him, and Croesus showed him around his palace, showed him all his stables, showed him his treasury, and then turned to Solon and said, who do you think is the happiest man in the world? Who is the happiest person who's ever lived? And Solon answered, an Athenian by the name of Tellus. And Croesus was slightly taken aback by this and demanded to know why this Tellus had led such a happy life. And there are two reasons, Solon answered. Firstly, he lived at a time when his city was particularly well off. He had handsome, upstanding sons, and he ended up a grandfather with all his grandchildren making it to adulthood. Secondly, at a time when, by our standards, he was a man of considerable wealth, his life came to an end that was as glorious as its course had previously been happy. What happened was this. The Athenians were fighting a battle against their neighbours at Eleusis when Tellus stepped into the breach of their crumbling line and put the enemy to flight. It is true that he himself died, but his death was something beautiful, and the Athenians gave him a state funeral at the very spot where he fell and awarded him splendid honours. So,
wow.
I think I'd go for Tellus. And of course, the sting in the tail is that in due course, Croesus gets defeated by Cyrus, the king of the Persians. Almost gets burnt to death on a bonfire and ends up basically a kind of minister in Cyrus's train.
Oh.
So the moral of that is never reckon yourself happy until you've lived your entire life.
Or unless you've been the Persians. I've thought of my answer. I would be Ptolemy the First.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I mean, what a great life that is. He goes off on all Alexander's adventures, all his conquests. I mean, Ali Ansari will be rolling his eyes at this and saying he's only interested in killing Persians.
But he's not, is he?
But he's gone all the way to Afghanistan. He goes all the way back. And then he ends up in Egypt, founding his own dynasty in Alexandria, dies peacefully in his bed in what? How old is he? 78, 80, yeah. 85? Or who knows? Founds a dynasty that lasts for 300 years. I mean, what's not to like?
Yeah.
I think he has a tremendous life.
Yeah. Fair enough. Okay, well, I think those are both excellent answers, and I compliment ourselves.
That never happens in this podcast.
We're very pleased with that. The 8th of July was 200 years since Percy Shelley drowned, with his body later being burned. Does he leave any record of historical significance? Do you have any views on Shelley?
I've never actually read Shelley.
You must have read Ozymandias.
Yes, obviously I've read Ozymandias.
I met a traveller.
Is it Shelley who wrote about Castlereagh?
Yes, The Mask of Anarchy.
Yes, exactly. But I've never really delved. The romantic poets are a bit of a black hole as far as I'm concerned. So I don't really know anything about Shelley. You must know loads because of your Byronism.
Shelley drowned on Byron's boat, which was called the Don Juan. So the name of his great kind of comic epic. And then when Shelley was burned on the beach, Byron couldn't bear to watch it and he wandered off and went for a swim, a bit like you. So one of the kind of the great romantic moments in English literary history. Shelley's a great poet. The image of him in the Victorian period was that he was Matthew Arnold described it as kind of a golden, ineffectual angel beating his wings against the dying of the light or something like that. But I think one of the recent trends, which was very much pushed by Paul Foote, who was Michael Foote's nephew. Was that right?
Yes, that is right. Yes,
so he was exactly. A kind of campaigning journalist who worked with Private Eye and very much on the left. And he wrote a book called Red Shelley, which kind of enshrined Shelley as a revolutionary. So Shelley was an atheist. He was a vegetarian. Very, very cutting edge for the time. And his poetry has that kind of strange blend of it can be exquisitely beautiful, but simultaneously full of woke tosh, I think.
Right.
The Telegraph would probably describe it as.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a great poet. Whether he's read now, I don't know.
I think the Romantic poets are still read, aren't they? Well, they're still studied, which is slightly different from being read.
I don't think they feature very highly in, say, school curricula. Partly because they wrote at such length.
Right.
In schools, by and large, people prefer shorter poems. So maybe the sonnet say Ozymandias. And there's a brilliant sonnet called, I think, England in 1819, about George III being blind and mad and his ministers being terrible people and everything just being terrible, which by coincidence I read last week. I was prompted to read it last week. So that's very good. Anyway, so yes, bless him, Shelley. Very happy 200th anniversary of his death. So our past episodes, of course, an absolutely epic sweep through the American Civil War. So we did four episodes with Adam Smith, and then we did one on Gone with the Wind with Sarah Churchwell. A lot of discussion on the Discord. And a lot of it was actually not just on the Civil War, but on America's future. And,
yes,
you know, might America be heading towards some reprise, if not of the Civil War, then at least of the fracturing of American society in the 1850s. The American Anglophile, I honestly think the US won't implode, just more federal and red states will become bright red and blue will become bright blue. So Dominic, you're very knowledgeable about American history. And I know that we talked about this, didn't we? Almost in our first episode. I think it was our second episode, wasn't it?
About civil wars, yes.
What was your take then? I can't actually remember. And what's your take now? And has it changed in the kind of almost 2 years since we did that?
I think it has changed, but not for the better. So if you remember in our episode about civil wars, we said civil wars are a constant of human history. Societies that think they're immune from civil wars are often deluding themselves. So I think the United States 2 years ago looked like the Western society that would be, it seems mad to predict a civil war, but it's the one in which there's the highest level of kind of political violence, isn't it? More than Germany, more than France, more than Canada, more than
Firearms.
Exactly,
which is a precondition, isn't it?
Is absolutely a precondition.
Because that was one of the striking things I thought about the assassination of Abe in Japan, was that there are so few firearms and it's so difficult to get a gun that the assassin had to make his own blunderbuss.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. That's obviously not an issue in the United States.
No.
So there'll be some people listening to this, particularly Americans. I'm just thinking about how they would react if they disagreed and they would say, well, this is rubbish. You're being hysterical. Most Americans don't care about politics and are just plodding on with life, which of course is true, but it's true of all societies before they have a civil war. I mean, it was true of England in the 1640s. It was probably true even of Spain in the mid 1930s. I think what you have you're very unlikely, I think, to have a scenario where you have, two great armies fighting at Gettysburg. But if you think that even now you had an attempt to cancel the results of the last presidential election, you had a mob bursting into the Capitol. You've had riots in the last few years, armed militias kind of openly parading in the streets. There was the violence at Charlottesville, Virginia, which was about, Civil War statues a few years ago. I mean, it's not like you need to inject something new into the narrative. All the ingredients are actually already there. And I think what's perfectly plausible is in the next 10 years, all that would intensify.
But that wouldn't be a war, would it?
No, it wouldn't be war. I mean, there's a book, and I can't remember the author. There was a book published at the beginning of this year by an American academic talking about civil wars. And she says that she thought the most likely outcome for the United States, the most likely bleak outcome, would be something like what the situation in Northern Ireland in the 70s and 80s. Now, that wasn't a war. It wasn't really a civil war because, all the time people were going about their daily life. But in the mid-1970s in Belfast, a bomb was going off or somebody was being shot pretty much every day, certainly in 1972, the height of the Troubles. Is it possible to imagine something like that in the United States? I would say it's not utterly improbable.
So the thing about the Troubles was that the British Army went in, supposedly to play a role as an honest broker. But that role as honest broker didn't last very long.
No.
So that's always a problem, isn't it, for peacekeeping? If you're trying to keep the peace in your own country?
Well, if once you've got troops on the streets and a community that is distrustful of the troops, That's a recipe for disaster.
So which side could you imagine sending in troops?
I can't remember if we talked about this in a previous bonus episode. I was talking to Adam Smith after we did our recording. We went for a dinner and we were talking about this. And his argument was as follows. And he actually wrote an article in the Sunday Times along these lines a couple of weeks ago. His argument was as follows. Probably the Republican Party is likely to be the dominant party in federal politics for the next couple of decades. They clearly have a majority on the Supreme Court that they're not going to give up. But also the electoral system favors the Republicans. So it's plausible that you would have a Republican-dominated federal government being resisted by Democratic state administrations in, let's say, California or Massachusetts or New York. And the argument then would be about money. There would be a point at which those, he said, you know, what you could easily imagine is that those kind of coastal administrations forming some kind of governor's association or whatever, who knows what they would call it, in which they say we're going to protect our laws or whatever from the encroachment of Washington. So it would actually turn the states' rights argument on its head. And then, and of course, those states are net contributors to the federal budget. They're the richest. So is there a point at which they start to withhold funds? Or, you know, they won't give up their money, they won't pay into the federal budget unless the Republican-dominated Congress or whatever agrees not to interfere with their abortion laws or whatever it might be. You know, you can imagine this scenario playing out.
Yeah.
And at that point, when you're arguing about money, you know, is there a point at which you have a particular state capital that basically is in virtual open rebellion against the federal government and the federal government sends in troops? I mean, you know, these are sort of paranoid, and people might say hugely exaggerated scenarios. But again, the point is, they're not that much more exaggerated than what we've seen in the last few years. And I think that's the point, that actually if 10 years ago you had said Donald Trump as president of the United States, riots on the streets, a mob storming the Capitol, a president refusing to leave. And
okay, so I went to see Elvis yesterday, the Baz Luhrmann biopic, which is actually great. I really enjoyed it. Baz Luhrmann's approach to filmmaking very much suited to Elvis in Vegas.
Of course. You can imagine. Yes.
But that had, as a kind of constant drumbeat, kind of appearing on televisions in the background, the cycle of assassinations. So Martin Luther King and Kennedy's and so on. And the sense of America collapsing into fire and riot. Were the riots, say, in 1968 worse than those that happened in the summer of 2020 or with the storming of the Capitol?
The riots in 1968 were, there was quite a high death toll, as I remember, in the spring of, whenever it was, that, or spring and summer, particularly when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I can't remember what the death toll was in 2020. So the riots were very serious, and of course they weren't alone. There were a lot of urban riots in the 1960s. But I think the political center held, as it were. Because, so in 1968, there were riots. There were also more riots at the Democratic National Convention when the Democrats nominated Hubert Humphrey. And the riots then were actually the police rioting against the anti-war demonstrators. But, you know, that election was contested between two relatively centrist politicians, Humphrey and Richard Nixon. So, of course, Nixon had often quite aggressive rhetoric, but deep down he was center-right rather than sort of hard right. And the political system was pretty resilient. And there was a lot of common ground. I mean,
because again, that's what Adam said, isn't it? That's what's worrying about the situation now, as in the 1850s.
As much as Nixon fought dirty, Tom, he never sort of, I don't think he ever really argued that the Democrats were un-American, that they were a threat to the integrity, they were traitors, they were a threat to the Republic, all of these kinds of things. The rhetoric is so much more heightened now. And of course, what's also the case is that in the 60s, they inhabited the same, you know, they were part of the same institutions, the kind of media institutions, cultural institutions, and so on. And Democrats and Republicans socialized in Washington. I mean, it was very much the norm for them to play golf together, to go drinking together. They were friends, actually, behind, as indeed, you know, most politicians are in most legislatures, so Tory and Labour and so on. Mm. They'll often go on jaunts together and they'll get drunk together in the bars. And that doesn't seem to be the case in particular. You know, Washington is unusual now in that regard, isn't it? Mm. It's so polarized. And it has this sort of almost religious intensity. Well, it is religious intensity often.
One of the things that I got from doing the American Civil War episodes and Gone with the Wind was I hadn't properly appreciated the degree to which Confederate mythology still had traction.
Yeah.
In the United States, basically because the only Americans I've ever met have all been kind of liberal East Coasters or West Coasters.
Yes.
So I obviously have a very skewed sense of that. On the topic of Gone with the Wind, there's a comment here from Maxwell Hastings who says, I have lived my whole life in the South and grew up watching Gone with the Wind, though I haven't seen it in many years. I definitely did not remember how problematic it was, and I think that's largely down to my upbringing in general. I was always taught that we, inverted commas, lost the Civil War. I remember getting into arguments with my grandpa about who the good guys were when I was 8 or 9. We visited loads of plantations as field trips, and the slave quarters were often either hurried by or there was some comment about how they actually didn't have it that bad. In many ways, it's shocking how little the South, or at least my little part of it, has changed since the Civil War. I have no way of, you know, of judging that, but I can kind of perhaps I have a better sense of understanding how that sense has fed into the current rivalries. And
we've both been to plantations, haven't we, Tom? I mean, you've been to a plantation. I've been to a plantation, and it was, I mean, you know, I'm very unwoke. You know, I spend a lot of my time fulminating against, well, for those, because some weird thing is that we did those episodes and some of the feedback. So we had more feedback on those episodes than anything we've ever done. I also noticed how there was slightly more pushback on those episodes by people saying, a couple of people saying, a very, very biased account of the American Civil War from your guest, all from a Northern perspective, all dissing the South. The war was not about slavery, blah, 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 blah. And frankly, I don't agree with that view. I think Adam was very objective, but also, you know, some of our critics would regard as a kind of a fascistic fanatic. When I've been to, I think it was Boone Hall in South Carolina, and it was exactly that. Go to the plantation, admire the lady in the crinoline dress, admire the lovely furniture, the slave quarters. I don't think they even used the word slave quarters. They said the workers or something like that. In those huts over there, we weren't taken to the huts. There was no discussion of the fact that the entire apparatus was based on slavery. I do think there is an issue there, actually, because the fact is, of course, people always make myths about their own history. And that's completely normal. All nations have their myths and blind spots. Britain is no different. But the fact of the matter is, the descendants of the slaves are still there. And to have any form of reconciliation, you have to at least, you know, you have to give them something. So having the statues of the generals and the statues that were put up deliberately to intimidate them and to remind them that this is a white supremacist order. I mean, you can completely understand why if you're an African-American living in Georgia or Alabama.
So there was some feedback on Sarah's use of the phrase white supremacist to describe the order that emerged from Reconstruction.
That's mad because it clearly was white supremacist.
That's what I have no knowledge.
It absolutely was. I mean, it was a world in which lynchings were not uncommon. I mean, we could do a fantastic podcast, Tom, on something called the Tulsa Massacre.
Oh, this is the one where they fight, where the planes.
Whether or not there were planes is apocryphal. I mean, it's contested. It's apocryphal, but there's no doubt that dozens, maybe hundreds of people were killed in Tulsa, which was then the sort of the beating heart of sort of African-American enterprise in the South by, you know, racist mobs with the connivance of the authorities. I mean, these things were not, you know, it was a white supremacist order. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, if you read any account of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the police are on the other side. The police are kind of the enemy. The police are kind of beating marchers, all of that kind of stuff. George Wallace, the Alabama governor who became the sort of poster boy for resistance to the civil rights movement in the 1960s. I mean, he, in his inaugural address and becoming governor, he said, you know, we throw down the gauntlet in the dust or something and we proclaim segregation now, segregation forever. I mean, this was, it wasn't it wasn't like this was implicit. It was explicit. It was absolutely overt. So I think it's completely reasonable for Sarah to talk about it being white supremacist, because in the South, it absolutely was. The other thing she said was that annoyed some people was that plantations were like concentration camps. And people said, oh, how can she say that? That's a disgrace. You know, blah, 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 blah. They're not death camps. But a lot of concentration camps weren't death camps. In fact, most concentration camps, Nazi concentration camps, weren't death camps. And in the sense that a plantation was a closed society, you know, ruled over by overseers who resorted to extreme lethal violence to keep the inmates under guard, it's actually not that bad as a parallel. I think it's a completely reasonable
parallel. Well, and there were camps where people were set to work without pay in Nazi Germany, weren't there?
Yeah, labor camps, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's no different. I mean, so she said, you know, would you get married at a 1930s Third Reich labor camp if it had a very pretty mansion? I mean, obviously you wouldn't. You'd see, but of course, people do get married at southern plantations. Of course, as Brits, you know, not only do we not have a dog in the fight, but a lot of people will resent us having any opinion on one side or the other.
Our opening match in our cricket season is played at a place called Font Hill, which is about 10 miles from where I grew up. It's an incredibly beautiful spot, landscaped, late 18th century. And Font Hill was famous as the site of a great folly built by William Beckford, very great novelist, but who was, you know, his wealth came from sugar plantations in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And I'd never really thought, well, the beauty of these surroundings has, you know, it has its roots ultimately in the exploitation of people in the distant Caribbean. And it doesn't make me think it any less beautiful, but there is a slight kind of nervousness there.
Well, this, in a way, if you take it out of that immediate context of slavery and imperialism, I mean, that's true of so many historical.
Of course it is. I mean, absolutely.
I mean, it's that classic thing. I remember my mum saying to me, some friends of hers, or some friends of my parents, to whom my parents took objection because they regarded them as woke toshmongers, had asked me when I was a very little boy, who built the pyramids? And I said, oh, the ancient Egyptians. And the person asking the question said, no, thousands of slaves built
the pyramids. Which, of course, they weren't.
Is that not true? Well,
anyway, no, it's not.
I wish I'd known that at the time.
No, it was an exercise in Keynesianism.
It was like the New Deal.
It was very much like the New Deal. It's building the Hoover Dam. Yeah, very similar.
But of course, we've had this conversation about the Colosseum, Tom. Dying in the Colosseum. You know, who goes to the Colosseum? I mean, do people go to the Colosseum and sort of kneel and take a moment to think of the slaves, or do they dress up as gladiators?
But I just think that there is something. In a way, when you go to a National Trust house or something, and there's lots of controversy at the moment about people drawing up lists of National Trust properties that have links with empire or slavery or whatever, and I think it's been massively overblown. However, you could say that. These houses, even on the most basic level, are monuments to class oppression.
Well, any palaces. You could say it at Versailles. Say it at the Schönbrunn. You could say it of anything, anywhere.
The servants' quarters, although they have been kind of, you know, people are interested in seeing them now, particularly after Downton Abbey, they tend not to be the focus of the visit for obvious reasons, because all the beautiful furniture and paintings are up in the drawing. I mean, that is a basic fact of looking back at the past, that the monuments are by and large, you know, Walter Benjamin, there is no monument to civilization that is not also a monument to barbarism. But I do think that with the plantation systems run in the Anglo-American Atlantic in the 18th century, and in the case of America, into the 19th century, there was something peculiarly brutal about it. Because even though the Confederacy would cast itself as an antidote to the industry of the North, in fact, it's the industrialization of slavery that made it distinctively and monstrously appalling, even compared to previous systems of slavery, which, of course, were also horrible. And I think that one of the reasons why abolitionism kicks in, you know, that slavery had existed throughout the Christian period, but I think it's the spectacle of the industrialization of slavery that brings home to Christians, this is a monstrous system, and also the racialization of it, that these are two distinctive aspects that are kind of qualitatively different to earlier incarnations of slavery.
When you think about that, one of the most famous images of slavery, Tom, it's the image of the ship, the plan of the ship in which the bodies are kind of arranged so that they can fit as many prone bodies into the hold of the ship. I mean, that was a hugely powerful and resonant image in the 18th century for the abolitionist movement, because this image of the bodies of Africans packed in like sardines into the ship in incredibly horrendous conditions. I mean, it obviously did persuade people and convince people in a way that, you know, any amount of rhetoric might not have done. So, yeah, I agree with you completely that the industrialization of it, it's the industrialization that seems to almost dehumanize it. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because we never think that way about Roman slavery. So when we think about Roman slavery, I think quite often people think about a man standing next to Claudius, let's say, holding out a scroll and saying, "Sign here, Emperor." You know, that's how we imagine slaves, isn't it?
Well, this has also been in the news because the kind of standard Latin course that people have been using in schools for, I think, three or four decades has just been updated to make the slaves seem less happy.
Visions of ancient Rome.
However, what I would say about that is that, I mean, slaves in Roman households could be sexually abused to a degree that by our standards would seem utterly repellent. Yeah. However, there is also a sense in which being a slave, a domestic slave, kind of serves as an application for a green card. So what is very distinctive about Roman slavery is that the carrot of manumission is always there if you're a domestic slave. And long term, that taint of slavery will be kind of washed away. So it's perfectly possible for the son or the grandson of a slave to become a citizen and in the long run become a magistrate, to rise up to positions of considerable authority and wealth. Having said that, you know, if you're a field hand, that's, I think, quite as bad as working in a cotton plantation. And if working in a mine, I mean, that's unspeakably awful, because there, almost certainly, you will be physically maimed to stop you from running away. So you have your foot chopped off, for instance.
That's horrible.
I mean, so of course, I mean, slavery is, in its essence, about violence and exploitation.
Tom, I was going to say, there's one other slave society that's never get talked about, which is Brazil. And we will be talking about the abolition of slavery in Brazil in the autumn, when we have a whole series of podcasts which we are keeping secret. Well, are we keeping it secret? I think we are keeping it secret, aren't we?
I think we are keeping it secret for now. But just to say that towards the end of the year, we have a very exciting program of episodes coming, which the listeners will be the first to know about. So the other episode that we did last week was on the resignation of Boris Johnson. Was a kind of, wow, something's happened that we should do an episode about. I think it was a justified episode.
It was fun, wasn't it? It was fun. It was about Boris in his place in history, his own view of his place in history. So you talked about him and Pericles, or Jack, our producer, or Dom asked about the Ides of March. And then we talked in the second half about where he stands in the course of British prime ministers, didn't we? And what did people make of that, Tom?
Well, and also we talked about whether the unwritten constitution works anymore. Carl W. thinks that it doesn't. So much has already changed that we now have a strange hybrid constitutional order. There is no agreement about what law is really constitutional and what bar a prime minister should have to pass before he or she can change any piece of probably constitutional law. We were both relatively sanguine about whether Johnson has done long-term damage to that. I wouldn't say blowback, but we had a exchange of views with Agnès Poirier, French journalist who was our guest, talking about Paris and the episode we did on Paris, who said that we need a written constitution.
Oh, that's just nonsense.
And that the British
going to get Valéry Giscard d'Estaing to write it like he did the European constitution.
Well, so what I restrained myself from saying was that Johnson was forced out, basically, for his record of scandal and criminality, but kind of verging on the, his constitutional outrages, whereas no mechanism exists for expelling people like Sarkozy or Chirac, both of whom were subsequently convicted of criminal offences, overtly criminal offences. So I said that I thought that actually the past 10 years have reflected quite well on British democracy, or at least the willingness of the British political establishment to allow existential issues to be debated in a way that I think other countries wouldn't. So mm-hmm. two obvious existential issues: should the very integrity of the country be held together in the form of the 2014 referendum in Scotland about independence? And then, of course, the Brexit vote, which was about the fundamentals of Britain's relationship to the outside world. I hated both the referendums. I didn't want either of them to be held. But I could recognise, particularly in the scale of the vote for change that those referendums embodied, that politics had provided a kind of a vent for deep-seated opinions that were held by a large swathe of the population that otherwise would not have been given a voice. Yeah. And the Scottish referendum went the way I wanted it to. The Brexit referendum didn't. I felt that it's better to have had those referendums than not. Because, of course, in France or Denmark or Ireland, they had referendums on the EU, and then they were just told to go back and vote
and again,
give the right answer.
I mean, I think what happened last time, obviously, when we talked about this, is we both said we thought the Constitution had worked, which it kind of has, because Boris Johnson has lost the confidence of his cabinet, lost the confidence of his party, and so he's gone, and they're electing a new leader. I mean, that's what's supposed to happen. He tried to resist that for... I mean,
let's not
over exaggerate this. He tried to resist it for a couple of days. It all fell apart and he had to face reality. I mean, that's sort of what's supposed to happen. Okay, he didn't, he tried to resist for a couple of days, which some people thought was a constitutional outrage. But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's not January the 6th in the United States. The other thing I think is that, now, of course, some listeners will say, well, they're being very smug and complacent. This is what Brits do. They say that their system is brilliant and they ignore suggestions.
But by and large,
change.
People in Britain don't.
I don't think most
of the British commentariat are the very opposite of smug.
They're self-flagellating.
I think they're paranoid and self-flagellating.
Right, yeah. Agreed. But I also think there's a thing that people do, which is they equate the success of their own political position with the health of politics generally. So, in other words, If I've lost, that means something must be wrong in politics, that the Constitution must be rotten. I mean, you know, I didn't get, I've said many times in the newspaper, so I have no problem with doing so again, that I didn't get the result I wanted in the Brexit referendum because I voted Remain. But that doesn't mean that I think it was either the wrong thing to do or that what happened subsequently was a complete and utter disaster and a cancer and a sign of decay. I mean, I think sometimes you lose and that doesn't mean that the system is unhealthy. Indeed, the fact that people succeed who you may regard as mountebanks, bounders, frauds, all that sort of stuff, I mean, that happens in every political generation. I think...
Well, it's the essence of democracy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think being a pluralist means you live with defeat. You live with the consciousness that you may lose at any moment. And you may often be in the minority. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's how it should be. So I don't think... I think those listeners who say, well, they're being terribly complacent because we've had X number of years of Johnson and we've had Brexit and all this stuff. That doesn't mean that the system doesn't work. That just means you've lost. And accepting and living with defeat without resorting to conspiracy theories to explain it is, I think, it's an absolute precondition.
Well, what
of
I would
democracy.
Also say is that the refusal of large numbers of people who voted Remain made the ultimate Brexit that we got that much harder.
Of course it did.
I think that the failure to on both sides to reach a compromise.
I mean, I don't want to degenerate into the Alistair Campbell, Rory Stewart podcast, although I suspect we would take a completely different line from them because they would say, we've had a hard Brexit disaster. I would say, well, frankly, Alistair Campbell's involvement in that kind of ultra-Remain campaign and that was one of the reasons that we ended up with the hard Brexit. They could have had Theresa May's Brexit, but they chose not to.
Well, Frederick on the Discord, about our Boris Johnson episode, I'm sorry, but I did not enjoy this at all. If I wanted to sift through the highlights of Ramona Twitter yesterday, I would listen to the deranged Campbell and Stewart.
I thought to myself, as podcasts go, Tom, as podcasts go, I think we're probably one of the least Ramona-ish. Are we not? Well, I mean, bloody Dorries and Rees-Mogg. I mean... I think the key to talking about politics, frankly, and I don't know whether I don't know whether the rest of politics adhere to this or not. I think it's to something. I'm going to congratulate ourselves one last time, Tom. We're both aware of the contingency of our own political opinions, aren't we?
That's
You know, as I've said many times on this podcast, you know, I've written opinion pieces that turn out to be completely wrong, predictions that are disastrously, you know, Theresa May going to dominate politics for a decade, all of these kind of risible predictions. But I think being aware of that and being aware that posterity will prove you wrong is a really healthy position to take. And as the sort of the fanatics on both sides who take the position, I am right, and they are, you know, they're Ramonas or they're, you know, they're Russian funded Brexiteers or whatever. I mean, if you're in that ballpark, then you're not adhering to the necessary pluralist rules of the game, in my view.
Well, robust stuff. And Dominic, I mustn't keep you anymore because you have to go to Stockholm Airport. Pick up Rachel.
I do. Yeah.
So to pick up friends of churches. Very best. Give her my
I will
very
do.
Best.
She'll probably be wanting to stop off and look at some tedious Lutheran churches. But there's absolutely going to be
you're
no
not
time
going to Gotland.
That. I've been to Gotland. Have you
but
been
you're
to
not
Gotland
going this time? Yeah, I have. No. It's absolutely full of churches.
Gotland, we went to the churches in Gotland, and the painted church is absolutely magnificent.
Gorgeous.
They're brilliant.
Yeah. I hope Rachel's been there.
She hasn't been, actually. She hasn't.
Oh, you must tell her to go. It will be absolute Rachel Morley heaven.
Right, I've got to go.
Okay,
bye-bye, everybody.
Have a wonderful time with Rachel. Have a lovely holiday.
Bye, Tom.
Bye-bye.